I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's intimate words. The world-honored one's inner speech, the Buddha's secret language. It's not a sweet taste, it's not a sour taste, it's not a salty taste, it's not bitter taste. Very plain taste. Welcome to those arriving this afternoon. You're looking at our ancestor Secho Chikan Daiyosho. In Chinese, Shui Do Jurjian. Who's awakening came alive when he heard his teacher giving this talk, quoting the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, saying, "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning," or "the world-honored one used intimate words, but it was not concealed to Mahakashyapa." And when he heard this, Secho Chikan suddenly awakened to its profound meaning. Standing there with the assembly, his tears fell, and he unconsciously burst out, "Why haven't I ever heard this before?" And after the talk, his teacher called him in and said, "Why were you weeping like that during the talk?" And Secho said, "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed to Kashyapa." And his teacher approved this. So this word, mitsu, means like hidden or secret. Also means fine, close, and intimate. And in Dogen's essay on hidden speech or intimate language, he says, intimate mitsu here means close and inseparable. There's no gap. Intimacy embraces Buddhas and ancestors, and it embraces you. So, though this story came from the sutra, you might know another intimate teaching that the Buddha offered that Mahakashyapa did not conceal. Do you know that? Do you know the teaching of Buddha and Mahakashyapa? Yarrow held up an intimate tiny flower, and Kokyo smiled. Yes. Yeah. That, you know, is not in the sutras, but that's an intimate secret. Or hidden, you could say, there's hidden words and holding up that flower and Mahakashyapa smiling. And Dogen brings that up. Keizan doesn't mention this. And I think there's many intimate transmissions between the Buddha and Mahakashyapa in the sutras and outside the sutras. So Dogen, what he's talking about this, says, there's, he does this little rant, right? Dogen rant. Many people bring up this story about holding up the flower, and they say, well, the reason this was this intimate transmission was that teaching by words is shallow. So Buddha used no words and took up a flower and blinked. This was the moment of presenting intimate language. And Mahakashapa did not conceal it means that he smiled when he saw this flower. Nothing was concealed. And Dogen says, many people tell this story. There are an enormous number of people who believe in such a theory. Sometimes they comprise whole communities all over China. What a pity. It's always amazing. Because Dogen, of course, celebrates this story over and over. But I think he's like, when we make up these explanations about it, oh, now I get to target his hidden words. This flower is beyond words. How could this intimate speech take place in words? So then Dogen says, if the world-honored one's words were shallow, you know, if his actual speech were shallow compared to holding flowers, then his holding up a flower and blinking would also be shallow. Dogen likes to unify everything. And, well, if one thing's intimate and complete, everything's intimate and complete. If one thing's shallow, everything's shallow. Those who say that the world-honored one's words are limited to forms or signs are not students of Buddha Dharma. They do not know that the world-honored one has no forms and signs. Buddhas and ancestors drop off all experience of body and mind. They use words to turn the Dharma wheel. Hearing their words, many people are benefited. Those who have trust in Dharma and who practice Dharma are guided in the realm of Buddhas and ancestors and in the realm of going beyond Buddhas and ancestors. Sometimes with what we call words and sometimes with what we call flowers. Many ways the Buddhas can teach. But of course, if words were all superficial and useless, the ancestors wouldn't have spoken. Intimate language. How to use words that cut through and uphold the source. Yes?
Do you mind if I bring up something?
Please.
There's quite a few stories about the Buddha's skillful means and the Buddha Shakyamuni Buddha teaching to different people in different ways. But there's also a story, and I can't tell remember what it's from, but you probably do. That's I've been on my mind since we've been speaking about this, but it's really puzzling and wonderful and profound about the Buddha teaching to an assembly, and I think it was an assembly of Garudas and Devas. And
usually, they're all there.
And everybody's there. And the point of the story is the Buddha speaks, and whatever his speech is understood by every creature, kind of in their own language.
Yes.
And so to me, that kind of takes what we're talking about. Out of the realm of, oh, well, it's intimate because you know just how to express something to the right person, or, well, understanding comes because we've been studying a certain amount of time, but it's kind of says something else about an ability to communicate to me. Because what is that, you know?
Yeah, the meaning is not in the words, and yet it responds to this inquiring impulse of the Garuda and the Kimnara and the Mahavraga and everyone in the assembly. It's an intimate meeting that each one receives in a different way. Yeah. And I think people often say that when the Dharma is really flowing, is that I feel like that talk was just for me, right? And everybody maybe says that, but in a different way. They have their own issue, but they feel like it addressed their issue, even though it was just one talk, something like that.
Music communicates in that way too.
Yeah.
The same piece of music can completely transmit, or art, you know, I guess in general, a depth can be transmitted or shared in different ways to different people. It speaks, you know,
yeah,
people.
I think so. Mm-hmm. And even to this person at a different time, it speaks to us in one way, and at another time it speaks another way. Yeah, there's no fixed definition of intimate language. It can take any form, actually. And it does seem like it has something to do with the meeting. I hear that in Nanette's point, too, about the meeting of the receiver and the speaker and the listener, we might say, even if it's not using speech and words. Intimate communion, kano doko. So this is now Keizan's commentary, and it's interesting how he got off on this track, because it doesn't seem to be really commenting on the story per se, but I think this chapter of this transmission of light is really like maybe the most beautiful demonstration of what we might call Keizan Zen, talking about this inconceivable light that, as we heard this morning, sometimes is called this old fellow, this old gal, or the Lord of the House. Keizan uses these terms that Dogen, for example, doesn't use so much. And so he's saying when the six senses are completely let go, and all conceptual, discursive thought totally settles to the bottom, and there's just presence. Nothing's happening. As he says, when you stop everything, at such a time there is something that cannot be destroyed, something that cannot be crushed. And it cannot be reduced to emptiness or existence, nor is it bright or dark. It's not called Buddha, Dharma, it's not called mind, it's not called essential nature. This is maybe this relates to the original story. It doesn't have, it's not fixed in some identified way with these, any of these names. It's nothing but bright light existing brilliantly. Not the light of fire or the light of water. Just boundless clarity and brightness. You cannot see it though you try. You can't grasp it though you try. It's just alertness. Or another translation says, it's just clear awareness. Once you let everything go, we might even sometimes be a little bit afraid to let everything go completely, because we feel like we might just disappear, the end. But he's saying, if we let go completely, it's not that there's nothing left. Actually, there's boundless clarity and brightness, clear awareness. And then we left off when these disasters, when these incredible forces of destruction at the end of the kalpa, the end of the of this world system, water, fire, and wind. Part of the cosmology here is that first this huge flood. Not, I mean, they maybe in old India saw it more like everything's a, the universe is kind of a planet, right? So in this vision, it's like a huge flood. Water washes everything away, and then there's like the scraps of things left on the strewn about, and then fire comes and burns up all the scraps of things, and then there's ashes left, and then a huge wind comes and blows all the ashes. So with these great elements basically destroy any traces of what we might call like matter, and it's that this is their vision of the end of the universe as we know it. So however the universe ends in modern times, we might say the universe, when it finishes expanding, then it starts contracting and condenses into like what was the Big Bang, and that's the end. These are modern stories, right? And then in the Buddhist system, then it starts again. This takes a while. But meanwhile, through all of this, when the whole universe is destroyed, it is not destroyed. This clear awareness. Well, that's quite a statement. So we're not talking about consciousness of a person, right? Something more intimate than that. Maybe we could even say like the source of consciousness and the other aggregates of body, mind, and experience. An inconceivable, boundless, unlimited awareness that doesn't come and go. It can't be destroyed. When the three realms and the six paths arise again, so the formation of another world system of sentient beings, that's the old way of describing that. When that arises again, and the myriad things profusely sprout, this does not change. So it's not like it disappears and then comes back into existence. This is a... Keizon's not making this up either. This is all throughout the Mahayana teachings. And it's a controversial teaching. Not all practitioners of Buddha Dharma would agree with this. And some people, great practitioners, furrow their eyebrows when they hear this kind of talk. Do you know why?
Well, it's starting to sound like a soul. It's starting to sound like a construct. isn't it?
And what would be the problem with that?
Well, to the ones who furrow their brows,
yeah,
it's there isn't no, 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 mm. no.
But why can't we have anything? What would they say?
Yeah.
But what's the problem with self?
Clinging.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think this is why they furrow their brows. Even though it's something very, very subtle that we usually don't cling to. This kind of boundless light. We have other stuff to cling to. We're working on some other, like, more grosser forms of clinging. But these brow furrowers, they say, well, when you get right down to it, if we're talking about complete, perfect enlightenment, this sounds like it leaves some ground for some very subtle types of clinging or grasping. And it's debatable because the people who actually raise their eyebrows and blink and smile at such a teaching, they say, this is not a grounds for clinging. It's said over and over that this boundless awareness is completely empty. There are no fixed reference points to get a hold of whatsoever. So thus the debate has gone on for thousands of years. And both sides are good. I think it's nice to really look at both sides and color and listen to the debate and hear what they have to say on both sides, because both sides, I think, have valuable offerings.
And it's a debate that will never be resolved, of course.
Probably not. Probably not. Yeah. We could say, what if someone proves the existence of such a thing? Yeah, but I think the very nature of it is that it can't be proven in the realm of human kind of logic and reasoning. And even the Indian and Tibetan practitioners who love logical reasoning, they are often, though some do and some don't, but the ones who do uphold the so-called Buddha nature teachings, which this is in the realm of Tathagata Garba, they say, when we get here and we're talking about this, there's a lot that can be said about it, but actually, even we say that we're not going to prove this through logical reasoning. It can't be done. It can, but it can be recognized in direct experience. So the generally in the traditions that are more that emphasize meditative practice and realization more are the ones that uphold these Buddha nature teachings about the indestructible empty awareness, and the ones that tend to emphasize more like the philosophical reasoning side of things, which can go a long way in practice, they tend to say, well, nah, I don't think so. Because anything that you analyze or talk about cannot be found, actually. And this sounds like something you can analyze and talk about. Yes?
I was just wondering how this fits in, like, with the Buddha, when he was asked questions like whether there's a soul, and that he just didn't say anything. Like, it's like, is it an argument about, you know, how many angels you can fit on a pinhead, sort of thing? It doesn't directly lead to the relief of suffering.
I think so. In the in the Buddha's early teachings, yeah, he was asked various questions about, interestingly, about does the self exist? I think there's maybe one about, like, does the self, and we're talking not about the small self, but the big self, the Atman, is like kind of like soul self. Does this exist after death or not? And we're so used to hearing Anatman teachings of no Atman, but there are cases in the early teachings even where he says, I don't say that it exists or doesn't exist, actually. But what the Buddha does teach about that Atman is that if you grasp any of your five aggregates, form, feelings, perceptions, subtle my mental karmic formations and even consciousness itself, if you identify with those as the Atman, then this is the definition of dukkha, or suffering. So, yeah, some questions are like kind of a distraction from the liberation from suffering, and some questions about this self are maybe some would say are actually important to the ending of suffering, but there's some debate about how to deal with them. But Kazan is definitely a fan of when the entire universe, not to mention all sentient beings, are long gone, but even the like planets and stars disappear, this doesn't disappear. And we're talking about here like a kind of clear awareness. Whose awareness is this? Right? This is not like personal. This is not my awareness. It's not consciousness. Even the Buddhas don't know what to make of it. And the ancestors don't know what to make of it. Or another translation is, even the Buddhas can do nothing about it. And the ancestors can do nothing about it. In other words, like, let's kind of play with this awareness and like shift it, brighten it up a little bit, or dim it down a little bit or something. And like, nope, you can't do anything about it. It never comes or goes, it doesn't get brighter or dimmer, it doesn't increase or decrease. When I die, it doesn't die. When I'm born, it isn't born. It has no, this is part of the problem here, it has no marks or signs or characteristics. And that's the way by which we know things and grasp them. You could say, well, isn't clarity a kind of a mark? I think the clarity we're talking about here is like, is not a graspable mark of clarity. Monks, if you want to reach this realm in person, here's the instructions. Want to? You must close your eyes for a while. And you know, usually in Zazen we say, sit with your eyes open. So I don't think this is literally closing your eyes. It might be, but I think it's like talking about let the senses, all including the eyes, just be. Don't do anything about anything with both the conceptual mind, but even the senses. Drop off body, mind, and the senses. Close your eyes for a while, regulate your breathing, forget your body, have no place to lodge your body. Regulate your breathing, we might say, is a practical instruction to let your breath become really settled so that it's almost like it disappears. Because another translation actually, instead of regulate your breathing, says, this is the place where the breath ends. It's a little different. Have no need for any relationship with things. Or another translation says, where there's no function. Well, maybe kind of similar. Relationship with things means like there's a self and there's things and we're in relationship. This is the realm where there's no relationship. There's just one suchness. Become like cloudless blue sky. Become like the great ocean without waves. Then you'll have some experience of it. We with a capital I, or another translation, if that sounds like, if experience is too much of a catching word there, a little bit of a stumbling word, another translation I would prefer says, then you will be somewhat in accord with it. At this time, even though the Buddhas and ancestors cannot figure you out, or the Buddhas and ancestors can do nothing, they can't, even at this time, they can't do anything about this, there is still a bright light. Komyo in Japanese, and that's the title of Dogen's Shobo Genzo essay, Komyo, or brightness, luminosity. And Dogen's disciple Ejo has a essay called the storehouse of brightness, samadhi, the komyo zo zamai, where it sounds very similar to Keizan here. Maybe Keizan's influenced by Ejo, who lived shortly before him. Similarly, like, as you come and go, it doesn't come and go. That the storehouse of light, and the storehouse of light samadhi is when you're in accord with the storehouse of brightness. It's this light, by the way, is not like the moon in the dark sky or like the sun. In this case, the whole sky becomes the moon, and there's nothing else remaining to be illuminated. The whole universe becomes the sun, and there's nowhere to shine. These are wonderful pointers, I think. This kind of light doesn't have like an edge to it where there's darkness outside it. This is the realm where there's no boundaries or edges. Everything is just brightness. You must experience this completely, or realize this completely. If you do not realize this realm, not only will you be deluded or confused about monk and lay person, male and female, or another translation is, not only will you be confused by monks and lay people, men and women, both are kind of nice, kind of different meaning, right? But one is like, you'll be confused by this distinction between, maybe I should get ordained, but maybe I shouldn't. That part. Not only will you not be confused or deluded about these distinctions, but you will transmigrate, or that you will be confused if you don't realize this light that doesn't come and go and has no distinctions. But you'll transmigrate through the three realms and the six paths of rebirth. While as disciples of the Buddha, you might look like monks, still you will end up in the hands of old Yama, the judge of the dead. Won't you be mortified? Or wouldn't that be a shame? So this is the classic Dharma from the earliest times of the Buddha. This is the end of birth and death, right? Is realizing this peaceful nirvana, which is even in the Pali Canon, the Buddha says, is the unborn, undying. Usually in these early teachings of the Buddha, he just talks about what it's not, right? It's not born, it doesn't come and it doesn't go, and it's the deathless. But he usually, very rarely in those early teachings, talked about what it is. Except occasionally he'd say, it is bliss. Not like happy-go-lucky bliss, but like the cessation of the slightest traces of discontent. You could say, well, isn't that just kind of neutral? Maybe actually the end of discontent is not actually neutral. It's like, it's actually blissful. It's like the reality realm is actually blissful. And even in those early teachings you hear that, and maybe that's when the Mahayana, and maybe even more particularly the Vajrayana, really picked, oh, wow, bliss. So this is a blissful realm. There's no place in all the many worlds where the Buddha Dharma of Shakyamuni does not fully exist. How can you fail to reach it if you seek it? It's not easy to acquire a human body. You received it as a result of good roots in the past. Okay, I thought this was interesting because this morning Kazan said, this body does not come from our parents. So I understand this to be that this morning's body, he was talking about our true body of brightness, of empty brightness, doesn't come from parents. And now he's talking about more like the conventional flesh body. He also said this morning, like, this body is not, doesn't have like flesh and bones. But I hear that now we're talking about the flesh and bone body, which we have to deal with this one. This one, I think this is a good thing to remember in the conventional world. He's kind of, now he's sort of grounding us in the, after exaltedly expressing this, yeah, fleshless body. Now he's saying, this body, this human body, is the result of good roots in the past. I think this is just a classic teaching of the Buddha. I think it's just wonderful to remember that it is just this incredible gift and blessing to experience this human body. You could say this, the light is, can shine through anything, but have this human body to let the light shine through. There's a true person, that old fellow, true person of no position, no rank, no qualities or characteristics, moving through the portals of your human face, your human eyes, ear, nose, tongue. If we haven't seen that fellow, let's take a look. I think it may be for frogs, it's challenging to look that closely. We don't know, maybe it's easier for them. We don't know. But it looks like they have other stuff to worry about. Sometimes they say, people like us, even if we're like, we're busy a lot of the time, right, in this modern world, but they still call anyone who can sit in the Zendo today, we call this a life of leisure and opportunity. My life isn't so leisurely, you might think, but actually, many people don't have time to sit in a Zendo for a minute, or the circumstances for it. This, a human life of leisure and opportunity is an incredible blessing because we can sit in the Zendo for even a few minutes, even a few days, maybe once in a while, to just appreciate this light. We're too busy. We can't even, we don't have time for this light stuff. There's like stuff to do, isn't there? So this human body came from good roots in the past, and our good roots that we're planting in this life, may they be a condition for another human body, unless you'd like to vow to be born in a pure land. I haven't chosen yet myself. I think the human realm is a good one to, you know, because we have translations of Kazan in English and stuff like that. If you reach once this realm, you will be completely liberated. It's not male or female, divinity or devil, ordinary or holy, worldling or sage, monk or lay. If you reach this realm, though you are a monk, actually, you're not a monk. Though you're a lay person, you're not a lay person. You will not be deluded by your six senses, nor will you be at the mercy of the six consciousnesses. If you fail to reach it, you will be completely deluded and enslaved by those. It's interesting that it's not so much, we're talking about something, we're not just being enslaved by our kind of habit, grosser habits, just that, like, have these six consciousnesses, the six senses, just their very fact is somewhat problematic. They just keep pulling us into duality. That's what they do. That's their job, actually. So it's not like we have to, like, remove the consciousness. It's just look to the source of consciousness. What is this consciousness arising from, actually? Or maybe another way to ask it would be, whose consciousness is this? Well, it's consciousness is consciousness, we might say. Well, whose is that? Wouldn't that be too bad? To be enslaved by these consciousnesses. It exists with you from the beginning, but if you still want to reach it, you must use your power or effort. Though no one is without it, people are deluded by their eyes and other senses. How much more pitiful it is that they transmigrate ever so long. Just look carefully, forgetting the senses and their objects. Have no recourse to mind or consciousness, and you will surely reach it. So, just look carefully. And this is what Linji says too, about this true person moving through the consciousnesses. If you haven't seen it, look, just look very carefully. How do you look like this? It's not looking with the eyes, it's not even actually looking with consciousness. This is why it's challenging. This kind of looking, very careful, a kind of mitsu kind of looking, a kind of intimate looking. You do not have to reach it gradually by stages. Once you arouse your determination or diligence with all your power, you will experience it. Even though it is brief, just immediately become aware of the source without giving rise to partial understanding, and you will reach it. Once you reach it, just as if you were standing on 4 feet, you will not be moved by the 8 winds. It's kind of a nice image. When we're standing on 2 feet, the wind can, if it's really strong, can blow us over. But it's as if we're suddenly very, very stable, like we have 4 feet. So hurricane force winds can't blow us over. And you know the 8 winds? Anyone know the 8 winds?
Praise and blame.
Loss and gain.
Pleasure and pain.
Pleasure and pain.
Yeah,
they all rhyme.
Yeah, so. Good reputation, bad reputation, or kind of like kind of fame and disgrace would be another way to say it. Yeah, so this is a nice little list, I think, that comes up once in a while, it's nice to remember, because these are the winds of the world, they say, that blow us off our seat again and again. There may be others, but maybe we could fit almost any of these disturbing, ungrounding experiences. We can put them into these categories, especially pleasure and pain is like, in a way, all the rest are maybe sort of outgrowths of that. I mean, because like disgrace is a kind of a type of pain, right? And fame is a type of pleasure. I think pleasure and pain is like the building blocks, and then gain and loss. We create pleasure and pain. Praise and blame create pleasure and pain. And then lots of praise and blame create like bad and good reputation, or fame and disgrace. So these are great things to watch in our life, right? That if we notice any suffering during sesshin, take a look for this one of these eight winds of the world. I bet it's blowing our experience. But realizing this realm, that old fellow can't be blown around by these winds, right? So right in the midst of of blame, you really blew it this time, Kokyo. You really got it wrong. I'm so ashamed of you. Meanwhile, at the very same time, right behind that, there's this great, perfect mirror just reflects that blame, holds it like a mother thinking, and it's called the light. Geisan calls it the great brightness. And thinking about it, it doesn't have any characteristics, so I hesitate to speak of this, but I thought, well, what? How do we have a sense that we're in accord with it? So this is a little bit off, I think, to say this, because it's a little bit like a mark. But if I was granted one trace of a mark, at least today, I kind of feel like, how about warmth? And almost like love. And maybe we say, well, that's not really marks. I hope they're not marks. But this kind of sense of like, oh, I feel so ashamed. And then stepping back into that light, it's like this warmth, this where it's all okay. Everything is completely okay. And then I thought of that, I thought, like a mother being held by mommy. And the Dzogchen tradition has this description, maybe of this, called mother and child luminosity. And so the child luminosity is our own Buddha nature. It's a little bit off to say our own, right? You could say the Buddha nature that's moving in and out through the portals of this face. And then the mother luminosity is like the boundless Dharmakaya that isn't connected with anybody's face. and in this practice, it's like the mother and child luminosity reuniting. So like you're personal, or it's not really personal, right? But your Buddha nature, completely in accord with completely impersonal, mother light of just warmth and love. So even when the winds of the world are blowing strong, that's so challenging because they blow so strong. They're like the big distraction from this light. You know? The ancients said, learning the way is like making fire by rubbing two sticks together. Do not stop a second when you see smoke. Once you exert all your power, all your effort, and we're not talking about kind of effort, we're talking about very, very relaxed, strong attention and looking without grasping. It's a very subtle effort. When you exert this kind of effort, you'll get fire. What is smoke? So don't stop when you see smoke. What is smoke? Which is like the signs of fire, right? The signs that there's a fire nearby. But it's not actually the fire. What is the smoke? When you encounter the skill or method of a spiritual teacher and not a single thought arises, this is when you see smoke. So I think this is one of my favorite sections, by the way, of this whole book these days. I really feel like this is a wonderful exposition of Zen version of what we call shamatha and vipassana. So we get these instructions in shamatha, a calm abiding, which means like totally just settling into the present, relaxing completely, where no thoughts are arising or there's no grasping any experience. Very, very settled. There may still be like little wisps of mind activity, but we're not engaging them at all. So they're just, come on, get all, no. It's like, as long as we don't like pick up on them, they have no juice, they have no fuel to continue. So this is sesshin. This is a time for this kind of deep calm abiding. Not to say that sometimes sesshin is a big troubling mess too, right? But it offers the opportunity because we get another chance. We get another period. That's the beauty of it. Until it finally ends. Then we get another chance. So this metaphor here, right, is that learning the way is like making fire by rubbing sticks or some kind of like effort to make fire. First you see smoke. What is the smoke? We get this method for practicing calm abiding. We get many Zen teachings. Follow your breath. Stay with it. If you wander off, just return kindly and gently. Present. Return to the present. 100,000,000,000 times. Let go. Relax. Be here now. I hear all these could be seen as like shamatha instructions. Settling completely into the present. And this is where we often stop. I mean, it is stopping. But it's also, it's so restful. It's so peaceful. It's like a break from these winds. Right? And this is, I think, the beauty here in this particular passage. This is when you see smoke, when not a single thought arises. That's good enough for me, we might say, but Kazan's here saying, this is seeing smoke. The fire's nearby. If you stop here and rest, it's like stopping at warmth. Smoky warmth. But if you continue on, you'll see fire. So what is it continuing on? Or what I would call vipassana. It's a little... A little twist here called, if you haven't seen this true person, look. That's one translation of the Sanskrit word vipassana. Means look or see. Really it means like special seeing. That's a kind of intentional activity, we might even say, a very subtle shift. I say shift because this is what how I understand Dogen to speak of learning the backward step. Of the backward step is a kind of a shift. The backward step of turning the light back. Turning the light around and shining it back. So, on, you know, the source of this one who's not giving rise to a single thought. And so this is what Keizan says. If you, again, when you practice this, this method to rest and not a single thought arises, this is when you see smoke. If you stop here and rest, it's like stopping at warmth. But if you continue on, you'll see fire. This means knowing the one who does not give rise to a single thought. Or another translation says, this means knowing that which does not give rise to a single thought. Knowing that one, with a capital O in this version, that one, the womb of light, that old fella, that bright empty field, that one that does not give rise to a single thought. There's just resting here, nothing really much is happening, but who is this happening to? This is the questioning, the looking back, turning the light around, the light of awareness that's just resting on the present moment. Awareness is usually ranging over all kinds of past and future stuff and like getting blown around by these winds and trying to push back the wind. And okay, now in shamatha, just settling into the moment. Now awareness is directed towards this experience of the present, very wonderfully settled and peaceful. And as turn the light back, who is resting here? Whose rest is this? Who is the one that's not thinking? We might even hear Dogen's think of what doesn't think. First, don't think. First let go of thought, and now think or look or question what doesn't think or who doesn't think. This is fire. Yes?
Who is asking the question? Who is not thinking? I mean, is that a moment of activity or intention where sort of you... Supposedly, maybe you've attained calm abiding. There's no conceptual activity or distraction. There's no sensual distraction. Do you, in some sense, have to make a decision at that point to turn the light inward? Or
it's a great question.
Does that just happen?
Wonderful question. Because, you know, in our actual experience, we can, if we get to this place, it becomes this kind of laboratory of like, what happens there? So sometimes we can look in our own experience, what seems to be happening, and then we have teachings there too about, who is that ask, because part of the tricky thing here is that the usual intentional mind that's trying to do stuff, we're letting that one really rest. The kind of effortful, trying, intentional mind, we're using that intention to rest the intention more and more, so like almost nothing's happening. And then I think there's different ways of talking about your question. One would be that, and I think actually that you can find classical answers that have these variations. One is that it naturally happens. Yeah, it's the you don't actually have to do this shift. That it's sometimes if I took up that point of view, I would say it's like the natural curiosity of mind. And when the mind is very, very subtle like this, it's very awake too, and it's totally alive. And its natural curiosity is like, and creativity too, I think. The natural curiosity and creativity of mind is more alive than ever. So it naturally, that energy kind of starts investigating. Naturally starts investigating. Wow, I feel like it's a little too indulgent to just rest here, even though it's very sweet. Let's take a look around. And so we might say it naturally happens. And then some would say, actually, maybe one does. And by one, we're talking about the conventional mind and intention. One forms a very slight intention based on past intention. You could say before, you say this period, I really want to, if I rest so deeply, I want to explore this a little bit more. And so when we're resting deeply, that past intention kind of comes to the surface. Let's take a look now. I think it's a great question, because in experience, it seems to be so ever so gentle. So one image of this is like, it's this really still pond. It's called shamatha. And that, but there's this fish called the one who's asking who, or intention, that's moving through this very, very like, gently and slowly, and if it moves too much, it ripples the whole thing and shamatha is gone. Or another image is, it's like this space, like this big room of stillness, and like out of the corner, like your mind's eye, like from a corner of this room, almost like peeks in to the room and starts at, whose room is this? Or what is this room, actually? And if it runs into the center of the room and starts taking photos and stuff, like, let's get it. Let's capture it and we'll look at it later. Then it's like the room immediately disappears, right? So very carefully. And we could say it is the one that's doing this vipassana, this investigation. We could say it's a kind of a dualistic consciousness. It's our usual fifth skanda consciousness. But some might say it's actually, it's like Buddha nature. It's like the light is actually coming in there. You might even call that, like, how does this happen if it's not intentional? We could say the light is like waiting for this person to settle down. And this person gets really still and settled, and then the light, our Buddha nature, is like, okay, now here I am. It's not exactly that it has some intention, right? But it's always here, right? And we could say, sometimes people say, it's like Buddha nature is like always knocking on our door. It's like Buddha is knocking on our door, but we're like too busy doing other things. And but at this time, we're not busy. This is the one time we're not busy doing anything else. We're just completely here. Now Buddha knocks, and we're like, yes, yes.
So I missed this morning, obviously, but the old man. Is who the old man?
Yeah, yeah. Kazon sometimes talks about this old fellow.
This old fellow
is another name for this inconceivable, boundless, bright awareness. Yeah, this old fellow, the lord of the house. Yeah. The house maybe being like this body and mind, this person. Yes.
Yeah, I guess it seems to me that what we're doing right now with Dharma talk, question and answer, and Dharma study, and all this is ideally at least honing our attention so that in a sense it'll be ready.
Yeah.
At that time.
Mm-hmm.
When we in that time come together.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, yeah, we're kind of tossing around. This is the conceptual world of speech and language.
Because it seems that otherwise, without that intention, I mean, people before the Buddha's awakening were attaining calm abiding and going on to the jhanas,
yeah,
and just hanging out there.
Yeah.
And then they'd be reborn for countless eons in the
formless realm. Exactly, yeah, as the story goes.
After that was done, you know, back where they started.
Yeah.
So it seems somewhere in our mind stream we have to, as I say, hone or sharpen or give energy to that kind of intention.
Yeah.
We don't just want to get to a very blissful place to hang out.
Mm-hmm. Maybe we liked it for a little bit. But yes, exactly. This is the Dharma, is to clarify this. And just, you know, and maybe I should kind of feel like, for myself, hearing it again and again and again, and like, you know, in many different ways, you know, and there's certain ways that keep coming up again and again in the Zen teachings, turning the light around and shining back. We had this whole sesshin where we talked about, you know, be glad. I'm glad we don't have to hear about that again. Oh no, here it is again. And yet, this is one way of speaking, but I think that's also a reason for all these different angles on Dharma, because different people will resonate with different aspects. And yeah, it's seeds are planted. And we might feel like, so along these lines, we might call this a kind of like maybe advanced instruction. We might feel like, I am like nowhere near this calm abiding. I'm like, you know, some people I think have this, and myself included sometimes, have this experience in sesshin where it's like all the busyness of our lives, when we finally settle, it's like all this stuff just like starts pouring forth. And like stuff that we were like not kind of working with or looking at in our busy day-to-day life. And now it's like, oh, this regret I didn't feel before, because I was trying to keep myself busy so I didn't have to experience regret and loneliness and despair and resentment and anger and all of these things. Oh, wow. This is, and you know, if that's your experience in sesshin, I think actually that's quite wonderful. I mean, I'm sorry that if it's painful, but but I think this is practice. I think letting this stuff come forth is like, now we're actually like facing, we're letting the experience flow through us. We can't bypass this step, I think. So we let it flow through, and if we sit long enough, especially if we really let it flow through, we like to resist. Oh, do I have to like deal with that thought again? And just like, yes, I do. let it through. Okay, I've exhausted it. After a period, after a day, after a week, after a year, after 10 years. There's some, I think, some habitual tendencies that, like, you know, crop up again and again in Zazen for me that I think took like over 10 years to exhaust. this thing of like this kind of like sleepy dullness that when I'm not actually tired. I think that was one of my things. And just, I had just to ride this out for like 10 years. And again, not that it never happens still, but it's kind of like, I think of like, kind of feel like I don't need to deal with that. Or whatever that was, it's something else now. It's other stuff to deal with. So I think that's good. You know, whatever needs to come through. And then we always can be ready. We might feel like, well, I'm not going to be ready for this calm abiding, this sesshin. You never know. That's the nice thing about sesshin. It could be the next moment. You're totally obsessed. Sometimes these are the times for myself when sometimes I find myself most deeply settled are right after like total stress, anxiety, attack. I'm just like this is just a ways. I just... let's just go home. And then I realize, oh, but this is my home. I guess there's no way out of this. Okay. Maybe because those times of like strong grasping are like sometimes have strong release that go with them. So sometimes even within one period, wow, I'm really holding on. It's just like this is like really in my face, just let go completely. You can shift any moment, so, yes.
I was going to say that instructions kind of back away. It's about the, how do you say, close your eyes, and then there was a whole thing about breathing.
Yeah, regulate your breathing, or let where the breath stops.
Where the breath stops. That reminds me very much of, it's probably Via Chodron Trungpa, but, Pema Chodron's Zazen, or you know, meditation instruction is very much like that, and they talk about the out breath, and that there's this kind of vast sky, you know, or emptiness, or whatever word you want to put on it. At the end, you know, it's kind of like there's this pause, which is just kind of complete.
Yeah.
And then we have to breathe in again.
Yes.
But that kind of that moment between the out breath and the in breath.
Yep. When the breath ends. Yeah.
And having this component of kind of vastness and brightness even.
Yep.
You know, just this, 'cause they also use the kind of imagery of the sky.
Yeah. Suzuki Roshi also says die on the out breath. When you're following your breath, your out breath, at the very end of the out breath, die there. Very similar. In other words, just cease, just let everything completely go. And then yeah, there's then light, then we're born again on the in breath. It's harder, I think, maybe to completely let go on the in breath. It's very natural to completely let go the end of the out breath. And in that moment between the in breath or the out breath, you could say, is that fellow is hanging out there. Also similar to in the Dzogchen teachings, they say, between two thoughts, that person, this empty clarity, is always present between two thoughts, which is somewhat of a strange image, because it feels like, it often feels like there is no gap between thoughts. Doesn't one just flow into the next? But maybe, if we're very attentive, there's this very slight gap, especially if the thoughts are slowing down between two thoughts. And it's not just like calmness, they actually say, that's one of these pointing outs of this true luminosity nature. Is right there. It's always, I mean, it's here with every thought too, but maybe easier to recognize it between two thoughts, which means that we can't recognize it with thought. So, anyway, if I had to say, are there any Zen instructions on shamatha and vipassana as a kind of like two separate practices, as they're often taught in the Indian tradition. I think I would say the story of Secho Chikan and his transmission of light, Keizan's commentary, I think is beautiful because I really hear this as a two-part instruction. Could you follow that? You want to hear it again? Yeah, we talked about it.
That part's pretty short. It's just because his commentary was so long, right?
Well, Keizan actually just says, when you have this method, some method, and it's interesting that he mentions, there's more like methods for shamatha, and maybe not so much methods for vipassana, at least in this Zen realm. It's kind of like Rick's question of like, who does that? Well, actually, it's pretty hard to talk about how this vipassana thing happens, but easier to give instructions for shamatha. So when you have this method, practice it, and not a single thought arises, this is when you see smoke. You're getting close. If you stop here and rest, it's like stopping at warmth. But if you continue on, you'll see fire. This means knowing the one who does not give rise to a single thought. Looking at, by asking, who are you? Who does not give rise to a single thought? And I think we can also do this if thought is arising, and there's actually many Zen ancestors bring up this instruction too. When thoughts are arising and you can't stop them, you can actually bypass, in this sudden school of Zen, you can even bypass this like totally settling to where no thought arises. When one teacher asked, I think it was Zen teacher Shijo, when I'm sitting and my thoughts are in this flurry and they just keep coming and going, how can I deal with this? And Shijo says, when your thoughts are in a flurry like this, look to the one whose thoughts are in a flurry, or ask, whose flurry of thoughts is this? And that one is not in a flurry. So at any time, it's like, this is Ramana Maharshi's, the great Indian yogi. This is his only practice that he ever, pretty much the only basic practice he recommended. Whatever's happening, just ask, who is this or who am I? So whether you're really, whether that you're being blown to smithereens by the winds of the world, whether you're totally settled, nothing happening, or anywhere in between, who is this that this is all happening to? Back further. What's happening to me? Who is me? Who really is this? And of course, any answer that comes in words is not it. Whose experience is this? If you are not thoroughly aware of the self, capital S, in other words, the clear brightness, that old fellow, the jewel mirror, like a massive fire, if you touch it or turn away from it, miss it. If you're not thoroughly aware of this, then even though it seems that you have found some rest now, and in so doing you're like a withered tree, you're nothing but a corpse whose spirit has not dispersed but has no power. So this is, sometimes the withered tree is praised in Zen. Become like a withered tree. Become like ashes in an incenser in a deserted shrine. This is the just cease part. This is the shamatha part. But then in Zen, then we hear, actually, there's a dragon howl in a withered tree. Dogen has an essay called Dragon Howl, where he talks about this. It's not just a withered tree of shamatha, it's a dragon howl of vipassana, a howling, bright sun filling the entire universe beginninglessly and endlessly. But if you just have some rest like a withered tree, this is nothing but a corpse whose spirit has not dispersed, but can't do anything either. Therefore, if you want to personally experience this realm, you must practice with everything you have, or you must penetrate thoroughly. It does not depend on meditation or croaking like a bullfrog. Maybe that means like sutra chant, reciting Buddha's name. Another translation says clam talk. It doesn't depend on Zen samadhi or anything, right? It doesn't depend on anything. If this light depended on anything, it would come and go, just like everything else that dependently arises and ceases. This light does not arise and cease dependent on conditions. His Kaizen's closing verse, what is the principle of this secret words unconcealed or intimate speech that's not hidden? It is called the indestructible hidden body. So in Japanese, it's Kongo, which is their way of translating Vajra. So this is really like, these teachings are particularly, I feel like this chapter is particularly has a very like Vajrayana flavor, and it's capped with this verse. This is called the indestructible Vajra, hidden body. That body is empty and bright. It's empty and clear luminosity. Wow. The indestructible Vajra, intimate body, Mitsushin. That body is completely empty of any reference points or fixed characteristics of any kind, and yet blazingly bright and clear.
Is that the same as the concept of the Dharmakaya?
Yes. The Dharmakaya is completely empty and radiantly aware. The Dharmakaya, where there's nothingness, then a lot of good the Buddha would do us. Of course, inconceivable. After all these concepts, conceptions, it's ultimately inconceivable. But words, intimate words, Asanga, the great founder of Yogacara Buddhism, said, how is it that our consciousness of our storehouse consciousness of all these seeds of past karmic events, all our dualistic experience from infinite lifetimes, how is it that this whole thing is going to be like turned inside out and revealed, this perfect mirror of wisdom. How could this possibly happen? How does the process even start of overturning the storehouse consciousness? And he says, it comes from a perfect wisdom seed of hearing from the pure Dharma Dhatu. So the beginning of this process actually comes through hearing words. I deeply appreciate that teaching. It took, you know, all of the universe up to the time of Buddha for the Buddha. People doing all kinds of spiritual practice. It took a long time for someone to discover this without any teachings about it. And now we live in the Kalpa of Shakyamuni Buddha, so we have these, the words are still around. Thank you for your practice and attention and devotion through which together we create Sesshin and the transmission of light assembly. May our intention equally pervade all realms and all space and time with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.